Well, you know, if people just spent more time outdoors on a clear night, just watching the skies, maybe take a good set of binoculars with them, I think people would be truly surprised at how often they'll see things that are really unusual. Now, a lot of times people will see aircraft, airliners and things that are coming into land at an airport, and they generally have some very bright landing lights that come down out of the fuselage that are right on the landing gear. And these things will, if they're coming right at you or in your general direction, they'll appear to be hovering, and then if the plane banks or turns away to, you know, make its final approach into the airport, it'll appear that, you know, the object has suddenly moved from a hovering position when, in fact, the, you know, the aircraft was basically coming straight at you, so it looked like it was stationary. But when you see something that'll cross the entire sky and make two right-angle turns in the process without slowing down and making no sonic boom or anything, you know that you're dealing with something that's, you know, truly anomalous and yet artificial at the same time.
Well, what do you think about the statement that was made about 3 months ago by several scientists that they found that, excuse me, neutrinos were traveling faster than light?
Well, I had heard that there was a breakthrough in this area some while back. In fact, there was a discovery probably about 10 years ago involving some research into something called the Casimir effect. Now, this was one of the tests that tended to validate one of the underlying technologies that finds employment in anti-gravity propulsion, and that is something called quantum zero-point fluctuations in the vacuum. I can explain a little bit more about that in a minute, but basically what they were looking at was the fact that there is all this radiation that's coming from, you know, stars and television stations and pulsars out in space and neutron stars. There's radiation that's going out in all directions through space, and yet we don't feel any of it because it's just kind of this homogeneous mix that passes through us, you know, without any harm. And yet all of these energies that are embedded in space-time itself do have a collective force that can be measured. And one of the ways that they were trying to do this was they would take a pair of flat, or as it was referred to in the experiment, foliated charge plates or capacitor plates, and they would bring them very close together, and they would throw a charge on them. And they may have actually been encased in a vacuum containment vessel at the time, so they could take all the atmosphere out of there that would, you know, have any kind of an influence on what was going on as these plates moved around. But what they found was that when you put a charge on these plates in a vacuum, that the closer they got together, there was a kind of a mutual shielding effect where there was kind of a shadow, so to speak, an energy shadow between the two plates, where the energy from the universe could not penetrate into that gap between the two plates, and it would actually force them together with a tremendous amount of force. Mm-hmm. And that what this did was show that, you know, there was this presence of this energy in the environment. Well, one of the things that they also found in the experiment was if they tried to fire a laser beam between those two parallel plates right as they came together and they measured the speed of light, that they actually found that the speed of the laser beam light going through that gap that was shielded by these two plates was actually going at something like three times the speed of light. So they knew that it was possible to find things that seemed to violate even all of the equations that were originally postulated by Albert Einstein.
You know, the only problem, though, is that it is another field that we're not supposed to know about.
Mm-hmm.
I have to file that under, secret weapons and things like that, because anytime that subject comes up, everybody says, no, can't go faster than the speed of light.
Well, but you have to understand that, I mean, and this is something, you know, I know several world-class physicists that are friends of mine, people I've corresponded with, who were generous enough with their time and their tremendous intellect to help me to understand some of these things as I was, you know, researching and investigating some of these things, and Hal Puthoff and Tom Bearden and Tom Ballone and a number of other individuals who have had occasion to talk to wonderful and brilliant men. And one of the things that seems to have been ignored about the speed of light is that this value of the speed of light, something like 186,000 miles per second, that is predicated on other factors that you don't see in the equations. Like if you were to break C down into all of the equations that add up to an equal C representing the 186,000 miles per second, you also have to take into consideration things that are, you know, much, much more advanced technical terms, but things like the dielectric permittivity and permeability of the vacuum of space itself. And this can have, variable conditions that are based on the amount of gravitational influence that a large, massive star might have on the surrounding spacetime. It's the same thing that produces what's called gravitational lensing, where you see stars in the distance around the edge of the sun that look visually distorted because of the gravitational field of the sun bending the light around its gravitational field. And so you can actually see things that are sort of, if you shield the light.
Well, I think we're talking about light traveling in a straight line, though.
Well, but you see, that's what gravitational lensing is. It's actually bending the course of the photons because of the gravitational field. And light is what they call Lorentz invariant. It's always supposed to travel at this same speed, 186,000 miles per second. But some of the equations they've come up with that consider all these other factors that are embedded in the makeup of space-time, mm-hmm. they actually indicate that every time the light from distant stars passes through a strong gravitational field, it doesn't slow down the light, but it has to give up something in trade for passing through that strong distortion of space-time. And the way it does that is it changes its frequency. And so this is something that is so fundamental, and this is something that I think eventually will be proved out. It's kind of my own theory, and that is that the reason scientists came to the conclusion that there was a Big Bang was because they would look out into the cosmos and they would see what they can perceive to be a redshift in the light of stars in the distance. And this redshift was thought to be the consequence of the Doppler effect, where a light source, if it's moving away from you, its frequency shifts towards the red. If it's moving towards you, its light frequency shifts towards the blue.
Yeah, but they have found that there are some things that when you consider a redshift, they make no sense at all.
That's true, and this is what I'm trying to point out, because if you consider the fact that when you look out into the cosmos with the space telescope that we have, the Hubble Space Telescope, and you look out and they say, well, now we're finding that objects that are farther away have an even greater redshift than the stars that are closest to us. That must mean that as the stars get further and further away from the source of the Big Bang, that they're traveling faster and faster. So there must be an anti-gravity force that's pushing the universe apart even faster. But they're completely ignoring the explanation of the fact that if that light is giving up some of its frequency and shifting into the red every time it passes a gravitational field of a dust cloud, a star, a nebula, a galaxy, whatever it might be, that means that the farther that light has to travel, the greater the redshift will be, and that's exactly what they're seeing. And it's uniform in every direction. If you look 360 degrees, you turn around, you look over the top, everywhere you look, you see the same uniform increase in the redshift as you look out. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the Earth is sitting right at the very center of the universe where the Big Bang originated? I don't think so.
No, I've always felt the same way. It's ridiculous to think we're at the center of the Big Bang.
Yeah, I mean, so...
And if there was a Big Bang, why is it that it all went on the ecliptic plane? It didn't go up or down.
Well, that's true. I mean, I feel that the Big Bang was probably an easy solution, especially for some of the earlier astronomers who, may have thought, well, this kind of explains God creating the universe. You know, maybe it's a way to look, sort of incorporate a little bit of creationism into real science. But I think it's a mistake. I think that the universe has always existed. Granted, it's probably a turbulent and violent creative environment. But I think that it's always existed. It always will exist. And I don't think that there was a beginning or that there is an end.
Well, see, that's another problem. The human brain cannot accept the fact that something has always existed.
Well,
it's impossible for us to understand that.
Well, and I grant you that, but you have to believe. I mean, if you have any kind of faith, no matter what it is, and you believe in a supreme being, in a God, you have to sort of imagine, at least in my mind, that if there's a set of physical laws to the universe, that even God has to believe and obey his own laws. You see what I'm saying? I mean, if an electron always has a negative charge in this particular dimension, then, you know, God has to work his creative magic, acknowledging that as a fact.
Well, that's another problem, you know. We think that everything is the same because physics tells us it's the same in our universe. But having only occupied this small corner of the universe, we don't know what we're going to find if we go out and explore space. Even if we go to the next solar system over, there may be other things that will change our perception of how things work.
Oh, I have absolutely no doubt, Ken. In fact, if you go up on one of the NASA websites that shows some of these incredible photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope showing these exploding stars and these colliding galaxies and all these, they're just these magnificent images and the colors. I mean, there are so many unimaginable things that are happening out in the universe, and that doesn't even get down to, you know, the level of what's happening atomically or whether there's, you know, organic compounds we've never even imagined being created. You know,
there is very strange things. If you look at the center of our universe, there's a cloud that looks just like a double helix.
I know. I've seen it. I know. It's just beautiful. It's part of what's kept me fascinated by things like science and astronomy and aviation technology. I think it probably got kicked off in the 60s, when I sat down, you know, with bated breath and I watched the first episode of Star Trek, you know, going where no man has gone before and all of that. I mean,
yeah.
It was truly inspiring, and, you know, it's a shame we don't have programs like that today.
Well, I was interested in it myself, I have to admit it, but I'm a little older than you. We used to watch it in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's just fascinating to me, the possibilities that are out there. I continue to hope that at some point, some of these technologies will, you know, if they're not completely declassified, at least they'll be acknowledged in maybe the same way that the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber was. I mean, it's not like you see these things flying around every day, but at least we know they're out there.
Well, but what's out there? What's out there, Mark, may not be what you think is really out there. And here's what I mean by that. The Australians admitted about 3 or 4 years ago that they had a way of spotting stealth aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of this?
Well, it turns out that the very kind of technology that it's referred to as ultra-wideband or UWB radar. It's a kind of radar that broadcasts multiple frequencies all at the same time. And each one of these frequencies will reflect off of the surfaces of an aircraft, even a stealth aircraft, in different ways. And what the technology does through the use of advanced computers is it computes the differences that are seen in the radiation that comes back to the antenna from the broadcasting point of origin. And it's kind of like, well, if I can't actually see you, I can see the empty spot where you're sitting because there's no reflected energy coming back from that. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's kind of like, okay, you have a photographic positive that shows everything in full color, but you also have photographic negative that shows things in exactly the opposite way they would normally appear. And that's kind of what ultra-wideband radar does, is it gives you a chance to see where you're not getting any reflected energy and you're not getting any background clutter or noise coming back from the environment itself. So it actually creates kind of a pocket or a spot in space where, you know, the stealth aircraft is sitting there absorbing all the RF energy from the radar and not reflecting anything, so it sticks out. And, in fact, this was one of the questions that was posed to people at Northrop. I was actually in a conference, a public affairs conference that was put on by Northrop at their production facility at Air Force Plant 42 in the early 1990s. And that was one of the questions I asked them. I'd read about it in Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine. And I said, you know, there's a great concern about ultra-wideband radar actually being able to detect the stealth bomber. And you should have seen the nervous looks from the panel of military officials when I asked that question. But the fact is that there are technologies, you know, and the only thing that you really can depend on is that a country like, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan simply don't have access to these kinds of technologies.
Yeah, because what I had heard about, Mark, was a technology that would allow you to see the turbulence in the air from a flying device, even if it was stealth.
That's true, and you can do that. And in fact, one of the there's a great science fiction film. One of my favorites is called Aliens, and one of the one of the characters in the film, he develops a little detector, and he says, "Well, this detector will help us to find the creature because it keys off of micro changes in air density."
Right,
and
exactly.
That's essentially the same kind of technology that they would use to look at the turbulence in the wake of something.
Because
like
you can hide the object, but you can't hide what the object does to the atmosphere as it passes through it.
That's right. And in fact, they're using the same kind of technology in the hydrosphere for detecting the passage of submarines and the turbulence generated by the props on the tail end of the submarine.
Would you think that if we developed the SR-71 in the late 1950s, a plane that could probably go faster than Mach 3, that's three times the speed of sound, of course, that we would have had a plane by now that would go much faster?
Oh, and I'm sure we do. And in fact, it's pretty much an established fact, even in the 1980s. One of the things that kind of popped up unexpectedly was that there would be these strange little earthquakes that seemed to be passing across Southern California, and all the seismic detection devices were picking up this boom, 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 boom that would travel across Los Angeles and the high desert, the Mojave, mysteriously going in the direction of Area 51, coming in off the Pacific. And the way they were able to do this is they would, you know, the seismologists would look at these earthquakes and say, well, what the heck is causing this? Because this seems to be a rolling earthquake that's actually moving across the terrain and yet not causing any damage. And that was when they realized that they were looking at a supersonic shockwave that was moving at Mach 5, which is, you know, something in the order of about 2,500 miles per hour, which, you know, was considerably faster than the SR-71. So they began to realize that there was something out there that was, you know, unseen and unacknowledged, and yet they could see the evidence of it by the footprint that it was leaving as it moved across the countryside.
Well, see, that's the thing. For example, there's a lot of people that love to write stories about some of these new planes that are coming out in China and Russia and places like that. And I think the latest plane to come out of China is going to be the J-20, I believe it is. It's a very huge stealth fighter. And an Aviation Week specialist actually said that we don't have a plane in our arsenal that could ever touch this plane, and that if we ever sent in the Joint Strike Fighter, it would be eliminated immediately. And I had a laugh when I read that, because he's predicating everything on what he knows exists, but certainly not on what really exists.
Well, that's true. I mean, because at the same time, he can't say, yeah, but we've got a whole fleet of flying saucers that'll take them out before they even get out of their own airspace, you know. I mean, you're not going to, you know, reveal the ace up your sleeve when the other guy has just created something that he believes to be a masterpiece, and something that will give him maybe a strategic and a tactical advantage in an air-to-air engagement. I think I know the aircraft that you're talking about. Is this the one with the forward swept wings and the canards up near the cockpit?
Yeah, it has it has canards on it, yes.
Yeah.
And well, it's not going into production until like 2017, I think.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that the world economy is in the dumpster right now. It takes a tremendous amount of money to be able to, marshal the industrial capability to, build these aircraft that are using, things like titanium and special castings and so forth, and all the skill that it takes to, wire these things, put in the computer. Some of these aircraft are even talking about using fiber optic telemetry that uses different colors laser beam to multiplex the different information that goes through these systems.
Right.
So, it's very exciting to see these kinds of things. In fact, if you look back to some of the stories that came out of the so-called crash of a UFO at Roswell, fiber optic cables were one of the things that they supposedly found inside that craft, and so the idea that they're now using fiber optic telemetry to control the flight control surfaces in jet-powered aircraft is kind of an interesting hybrid application of a technology that seems so alien to us, 60 years ago.
I sort of hate to say this, but that's what Corso said, and a lot of things he said just were not true.
Well,
For example,
sure,
he was talking about the development of the transistor and how we got it from a crash of a flying saucer. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you trace the development of the transistor, you can see that years of hard work went into that until it finally was perfected by, what was his name, Flatley, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I think it might have been Laffley.
Yes. And we actually, you could actually trace the existence of that. It didn't come from any flying saucer. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you realize, of course, that when we began researching things like the electric motor and semiconductors and ways to control and monitor the flow of electricity to be able to send information or collect information using electricity, there's been an interesting divergence of different kinds of material science and technologies that have been incorporated into electronics that now give us things like 3D television that you can watch right in your living room with a
set of dark glasses. Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100% on that.
I don't think it's necessarily true that everything that we have today in terms of, the micro-miniaturization of circuitry came from, a crash flying saucer in 1947. But I do think that you can learn an awful lot from somebody else's solutions to these really advanced challenges, these problems that come up when, trying to figure out how do you get, an image of an atom with electrons, circulating around it. How do you create an electron scanning microscope, or how do you use laser light to be able to detect the sounds in a window as they vibrate, the glass window of a room, half a mile away. You look at the modulations of the light, laser light that's reflected off that window, and you could hear everything that's being said in that room. Things like this that just seemed unimaginable in the 1940s are now,
I just think the human race doesn't get enough credit, if you want to know the truth. And I do think that there have been, like Roswell, I believe Roswell was a legitimate event, and some of the others. But I think saying everything, and I'm not saying you say this, but I think saying everything comes from, flying saucer technology, which a lot of people do. Anytime they don't understand anything, they go, well, we must have got that from the aliens. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It gets a little ridiculous after a while. It's like the human race doesn't even exist. Why give them any credit for anything,
Well, I know. There are lots of stories in the defense and the aerospace industry of these young students coming up through college, MIT or Caltech or the Embry-Riddle Aeronautical Engineering Institute down in Florida, In fact, I have a nephew down there who kind of falls in this category. It's one of my brother's sons. And, you know, you find someone who is so passionate and so obsessed and enthusiastic about a particular area of research that they become a genius, a true shining star in an area of expertise. And sometimes these people single-handedly are making breakthroughs that people in high political office in the government, the defense industry, the Pentagon, they take notice of these individuals and, you know, they quietly take them aside and say, look, you know, we're really impressed by you, and we would be very happy to bring you on board with one of our secret research programs. You know, you can't say anything about it. You can't talk about it. You'll have carte blanche funding up the kazoo. But we want to see how far you can go with these ideas that you have under development. Are you interested? And I would tell you that about 9.5 times out of 10, those young people are going to say, absolutely, where do I sign up? And that is where a lot of these truly unimaginable discoveries and breakthroughs, I think that's where they come from. Mm-hmm. Not from some flying saucer that crashed in Roswell, but from people who were really thinking outside the box, people who were so passionate about what they were doing.
This is a
part of our culture that I think remains completely unsung and unnoticed, you know, because people are saying, well, why are we going to the moon? You know, we have people starving in the streets. Okay, that's true. But those people might also die in a hurricane, because if we didn't take the time to go to the moon, we wouldn't have satellites to tell us that there's a giant hurricane coming in from the southwest and is about to roar up the eastern seaboard and wipe out half the cities there, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's where you put your priorities and what you think is important, and looking ahead to see how these technologies might help our society and save lives and do good things.
Well, we've gone on for an hour and a half there. You have any more left in you? Would you like to go a little farther?
I always enjoy our discussions, yeah. Ken, because, I mean, you know, it's kind of like it's an open book session where, you know, anything can be on the table. And, I mean, just look how this conversation's evolved. It's been wonderful. I love this.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I like it, too. There's a treaty that prevents nuclear weapons from being put into space. It's said that we are using kinetic weapons that are in orbit, such as large rail guns that shoot telephone pole-sized objects that could hit earthly targets with the force of a small nuke. What do you think about this? I know it's not a violation of the treaty, but is it a moral violation of the treaty?
Well, I think there's a distinction between weapons in space and nuclear weapons in space. I mean, we do have satellites, and even the Russians have satellites that use I think what are called thermionic or nuclear-powered reactors that actually keep these things running for years and years, using the heat from about an 11-pound ball of plutonium dioxide 238, which is just below what it would take to have critical mass, but it will get really, really hot. I mean, it'll glow yellow hot enough to produce steam if you run water around it and drive a steam generator and a turbine and, you know, an alternator and power and all those kinds of things, not to mention, you know, the fact that you can use the sun as a source of power, too. But when I worked in General Dynamics in the early 1980s, I remember being asked to do some technical drawings for a bank of capacitors that were designed to power the electrical rails for a railgun weapon system. And at that time, those were the early days of development for a so-called railgun-type weapon system. And basically what the railgun does is it has a ceramic bullet. At least in the early developmental stages, it had what amounted to a ceramic brick that was suspended between two large copper rails that ran down the inside of a composite, probably a carbon fiber gun barrel that had sort of an elliptical outside shape to it, or cross-section. And directly behind this ceramic bullet was I think it was an aluminum wafer that would be sitting just a short distance away from making contact with these two copper rails. And the two copper rails were then charged up with the positive on the one side and the negative charges on the other rail from all of these capacitors, which would store, you know, several million volts of electricity. A capacitor is really just two conductive plates that are separated by an insulator like glass or silica or quartz. And the electrical charge can be built up as a potential that sits there. It's trying to jump across the gap represented by this insulator because positive and negative charges are attracted to one another. And so that potential sits there. And the potential can be built up from anything. It can be built up from a nuclear power source, from a set of solar panels that convert electricity from sunlight. But you store this potential on these capacitors, and then once you've acquired a target and you figure out, just like a skeet shooter would want to figure out, how much am I going to have to lead the target so that by the time my bullet travels from here where I am to where the target is going to be a few seconds from now, you actually lead your target, just like in skeet shooting. And so you compute the trajectory of the target. You swing your gun barrel across, say if you're floating as a satellite out in space, and then you dump all of this electricity into those two rails inside the barrel. And then with a slight little puff of nitrogen gas, you send this aluminum wafer, and it flies up the barrel, and it shorts out the two rails. And as it does, it basically is accelerated up the length of those two rails, pushing the ceramic bullet along with it, and it can accelerate and move this ceramic projectile at speeds of something like, 7,000 feet per second, something like that. It's a tremendous velocity. And the reason, when these things were being tested on the ground, the reason they had to use a ceramic very similar to the space shuttle tiles is because the bullet itself would leave with such a tremendous muzzle velocity that if it was made out of anything else, it would melt within the first 100 yards to the point where it would just vaporize.
They don't have that problem in space, I'll tell you that.
No, they don't.
They're using 20-foot-long, I think, titanium poles.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to understand, of course, that object, whatever that projectile is made of, as the object that is going to be responsible for delivering the kinetic energy, it's still going to have to pass through a part of the atmosphere to hit anything that's on the ground. And so in that instance, it'll actually become very much like a meteor that's
Absolutely,
coming down
yeah.
out of space. It'll start to burn up unless it has some kind of heat ablative material or some other advanced technology means of sort of, giving the oncoming air sort of a barrier, maybe even, some like a force field or something that separates the air and prevents it from making contact with the projectile itself, so there's no friction at all.
Well, whatever it has, they're not talking about that part of it.
Well, I can understand why they wouldn't do that, but you can see that. I mean, the idea behind anti-gravity, especially systems that, and people have seen these things moving through the air at 9,000 miles an hour without producing a sonic boom and making right-angle turns at those speeds without slowing down. So you have to understand that whatever the propulsion system is, it's completely negating the mass of the object. Now, in the case of a kinetic weapon, you would not want to do that because if you negate the mass of the projectile, of course, it won't have any kinetic force. It won't have any kinetic impact when it hits. And so in one way, you can imagine that they would want to find a means of allowing it to pass through the atmosphere with the least amount of resistance possible and without burning up before it hits a target. But at the same time, you would want it to be able to deliver the full measure of its kinetic energy on a target.
Maybe it would be better, though, if it was heated to a certain extent,
Well, I imagine so, because if it was extremely hot upon impact, not only would it be delivering the energy, but the liquefaction of the metal itself as it comes into the target would actually do more to deliver the energy into an underground bunker or a building on the surface, anything like that. It would do a tremendous amount of damage. I mean, in the same way that, some of the, I have a friend who used to be a sniper in the Marine Corps, and he talked about some of the experiments that he was privy to where they were using 50 caliber machine gun rounds in a special kind of sniper rifle. I think it was called the M144.
Well, that's what they use now, yes.
Yeah.
50
well,
caliber
but,
rifle,
but
yeah.
He was saying that they had done experiments, and I think it's probably a violation of international law right now, but they had done experiments where they had drilled out the core of a 50 caliber machine gun round that's used in this kind of sniper rifle, and they filled it with mercury. And they said that when the projectile would hit a vehicle, that the mercury would fan out in its liquid form, but it still had the same degree of kinetic energy, and that it would destroy anything in the vehicle because of its sheer velocity, and it's quite heavy. Mercury, I think, sits right next to gold on the periodic table, so it's a very heavy metal, even if it's at liquefied at room temperature. But can you imagine something like that, with a muzzle velocity of 3,600 feet per second?
Yeah, it's very environmentally damaging.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I mean, if it gets if you're an individual and it penetrates into your circulatory system, it'll probably kill you in a matter.
Well,
of
not only minutes. That, just getting in the ground, if you fire enough of it, you'd be poisoning everybody.
That's true.
You know,
and that may be one of the reasons why it may be a violation of international law for that very reason.
Well, I'll tell you, I sort of doubt it, and I'll tell you why. We've been using expended uranium rounds now.
Mm-hmm.
For years, and they've caused tremendous damage to local populations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen pictures of the birth defects in some of those populations, and it's horrendous.
And yet you don't hear anything about that being against international law.
Well, I think that there is a movement afoot to do that. I know that there is a lot of popular support for banning the use of depleted uranium. Now, people think that the problem that's causing the birth defects is that the uranium is radioactive, and it's not. Depleted uranium, while it's still, it would qualify as an isotope of uranium, it doesn't have the radioactive component to it that, weapons-grade uranium or the kind that you would see used in a nuclear reactor would have. It's actually just one step away from being lead, which is, of course, the next thing that uranium turns into after it's gone completely inert. And so the reason that depleted uranium is used is because it's one of the heaviest metals out there, next to lead itself, and yet it's quite a bit harder as an alloy or as a metal. And so, making use of it in a high-velocity projectile, like in a tank or an artillery round or something like that, it delivers such a tremendous and hard-hitting force that when these projectiles hit an armored vehicle, they tend to go right through them like a hot knife through butter.
You know, NASA has designed a new capsule that looks like a larger Apollo capsule with mm-hmm. advanced electronics and states that it'll be used to send people to the moon in 20 years. Does this sound like a delaying tactic to you so that no one will question why we never went back to the moon?
Well, there's a lot of mythology surrounding why we didn't go back to the moon. There's, Richard Hoagland with his story that, we encountered some alien race on the moon and they basically said, don't come back. There's the whole Apollo 18 story that there's actually an organism living on the moon that's, a big threat to human beings if it was ever, inadvertently brought back. I'm skeptical about that kind of stuff. I think personally that, at least as a public relations program, that NASA had a really difficult time justifying the expenditure of billions of dollars to create this political victory for America, internationally speaking, that we were the first ones to get there, and we bring back a few rocks that are in the Smithsonian and probably worth 20 times their weight in gold because of the sheer value of and the rarity of these objects. And but I think that there are probably secret space programs that have human beings sitting on the far side of the moon and probably on Mars as well, as we speak, that are there, not so much as a military exercise or as a strategic vantage point, but as a way of mining and refining very special kinds of materials in a low gravity environment. There's been a lot of photographs that have made their way out of some of the NASA websites that strongly suggest that there was life of some kind, at least somewhere in the past on Mars. I mean, you see these things that they look clearly like fossils of crinoids and trilobites and things that once existed here on Earth in a prehistoric ocean. So I think that something must have happened on Mars that stripped away its atmosphere or its oceans or whatever, but it sure looks to me like at least at one time there was life on Mars, and today it may be us, just in a secret kind of way.
Well, it's disappointing to me to see a rocket that is not much more advanced than a Saturn V being touted as the vehicle that the capsule will go on, and because it accounts for almost zero advancement in technology since the Apollo program.
I know.
There's something wrong here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Ken. I think that if you look at what we did between 1962, I think it was, when John F. Kennedy made a speech about, we plan to go to the moon and other places in this decade, or before this decade is out, and they did it by 1969. They did it in less than 7 or 8 years. And the idea that we're now going to sort of re-engineer the Saturn program again, and it's going to take us, another 15 or 20 years, it just doesn't make sense to me. And I think you're absolutely right. It sounds like a stalling tactic.
And not only that, we had several Saturn V's left over that we never used.
Yeah. I think one of them is actually sitting as an exhibit outside the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, and I think there's another one that's at Cape Kennedy, and there might be one at the Houston Space Center also.
And how do
yes, you're right.
How do we know there aren't several that are ready to go?
Well, I mean, that's a very strong possibility. I mean, if you look at scenarios like the film that we talked about, things like Armageddon and Space Cowboys and stuff, the possibility of a rogue asteroid coming towards Earth, and how would we go out and meet it in time to destroy it or divert its course in such a way that it wouldn't strike the Earth and kill hundreds of millions of people in an extinction level event. I mean, it really seems to me that I can imagine that not only the United States government, the governments of many of the other countries, the superpowers, would probably get together and say, this is something very real, a threat that we have to consider that may suddenly appear, in an unpredictable way, that there may be, an asteroid that's on a course that, passes behind the sun and we won't see it until the last minute. We may only have a matter of days to put up some kind of defense. We really need to have something on the shelf, ready to go at a moment's notice. And you may be right. There may be a place somewhere in Russia like the so-called M region or Area 51 here in the United States where they have a huge underground silo with some giant rocket at the ready with, some ultra-powerful nuclear weapon that's prepared to go up and blow apart or at least divert the course of an asteroid that might suddenly appear and pose a major threat to the United States and other countries in the world.
Do you think that superior electronics can make an aging plane just as deadly as a modern one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the flight envelope of the aircraft and the airframe itself probably won't be improved because you're limited by the material science that was applied in the development of the aircraft. I mean, I know that when I worked on F-106s, the so-called Delta Dart, built by General Dynamics and Convair back in the 1950s, about the time I was being born, that was state-of-the-art. It was, at one time, one of the fastest single-engine interceptors ever built. In fact, they later used that same engine times two in the prototype for the SR-71. So, you know, those planes wound up being re-engineered and retrofitted as drones for some of our pilots to fly out and basically go up against in these war games out over the Gulf of Mexico, out of Tyndall Air Force Base and other places along the Gulf Coast. And what they would do is they would actually turn them into giant remotely piloted vehicles that could be, you know, moved around and controlled. So, yes, you could probably retrofit an older airframe with newer technology, not only as a sort of a kind of a sleeper surveillance platform, if you will, you know, like, you know, some of these old planes that are being used to...
B-52.
Yes. I mean, you know, there's a perfect example of an aircraft that was developed right about the same time that I was born in the early 50s that has gone through so many retrofits. And yet it's still using some of these same old engines, using burning JP-4 or something like that, the black smoky trails when they take off. And, you know, I mean, but that is an aircraft, believe it or not. It has eight engines situated two apiece in four big nacelles. And this thing is actually capable of supersonic flight. If you go up on the Internet, Google B-52, you know, and you can see a photograph of a B-52 actually breaking the sound barrier with a big shock cone of vapor around you know, the leading edge of the wing where it joins with the fuselage. It's an amazing photograph. But most people don't realize that aircraft was supersonic capable even back in the 50s. And so, you know, they've clipped the vertical tail on it to make it a little bit smaller in terms of its radar cross section, and they've, you know, painted it with some materials that make it a little bit less obnoxious on radar. But it's really just a platform for delivering conventional weapons these days. It's really not one of our frontline defenders anymore, as far as I know. I think there's probably less than 100 of them flying anymore. Used to be, I think, something around 450, 470 of them in their early production numbers. But
well, the interesting thing is I think each one holds 52 cruise missiles.
Well, they can, and that's not only up in the internal weapons bays that were designed for the original, 500-pound bombs that they were dropping in Vietnam, but they also have a number of pods that can be slung under the wings that carry, I believe, up to 24. I think it may be either six or nine cruise missiles on each pod, in addition to the ones that are carried internally. So it's more of a standoff weapon, because the B-52 is relatively slow for its size, and it's a big, big target on radar. So it could be taken out quite easily, even by, you know, a country with, you know, even just a moderate amount of anti-aircraft missile defenses. Particularly somebody who might be in league with the Russians or the Chinese and buying weapon systems from them. So, you know, cruise missiles give you the advantage in that they do exactly what the name suggests. They're launched from the plane, their wings pop out, the engine starts, and they drop down to a flight route that basically is following the terrain, just, you know, a few hundred feet off the ground, using mountain ranges and valleys and river gorges and things to basically mask their approach to the target. And then right at the last minute, before they hit the target, they pop up and come in at a steeper angle and deliver their payload. And with the GPS tracking system worldwide being as accurate as it is now, I mean, these weapons are capable of being brought into and delivered on target within just a few feet of the most critical and valuable part of that target. So it's the kind of thing where, you know, the B-52 may not be state-of-the-art anymore, but it has a weapon system that is. And that weapon system allows it to launch from a safe distance and then turn away and go home. So it's, you know, it can be a very lethal platform, even as old as it is.
Okay, here's the last question I have for you tonight.
Okay.
There's been talk that we now have a very high-flying blimp that is black, triangular in shape, and can fill in for a satellite over a target if need be. Have you heard of this?
Well, yes, I have. And, in fact, a friend of mine, Bill Scott, who used to work as an editor for Aviation Week, says that he's actually interviewed a couple of servicemen who've seen something like that flying in and out of Area 51 and out of Edwards Air Force Base in the high desert above Los Angeles. And these things are quite large, maybe as long as 600 to 400 feet, 600 feet long, 400 feet wide. Because they are lighter-than-air vehicles and because they're made almost entirely of composite materials like Kevlar and carbon fiber, they have almost no radar cross-section or reflectivity at all. They're almost entirely transparent to radar. And with the proper application of stealth technology, as I was saying before, you could have a set of jet engines buried inside this thing with acoustic cancellation technology and a little nozzle up on the top or the bottom that basically directs the flow of the exhaust stream from these jet engines so that these things can move at a pretty good clip, 450 miles an hour, and do so almost in complete silence and with a very substantial payload. So yes, I think that that not only do they exist, but the technology is certainly there. I mean, I saw a report back in the early 1990s that was part of a presentation to the I think it was the Royal Academy of Aeronautics in London, it described a proposed vehicle that had actually been patented by a company called Aerion. Based in Princeton, New Jersey, and it called for exactly this kind of an aircraft, although the patent drawings showed little pods on the back of it with propellers like the flying wing from the Second World War. It was being proposed as an airborne, I think it was called a bistatic radar transmitter station. And basically what a bistatic radar transmitter station is, it's a flying radar antenna that can either receive reflected radar energy. Say you're wanting to know in real time what's happening inside of an enemy country, and you don't want to invade their territory and, you know, precipitate an international incident, but you do want to know exactly what's going on with the movement of their military vehicles and aircraft, this kind of thing. And so you have an AWACS airplane on one side of the country that's broadcasting a powerful radar signal, very focused radar signal, into the specific region that you're interested in. And then on the other side of the country, at a high altitude, you've got this big, giant, triangular-shaped blimp, stealth blimp, with a big radar antenna in it, like a big ear, listening for all that reflected radio frequency energy that's being broadcast by the AWACS plane, and it gives you a chance to see very clearly what's going on inside that country without ever crossing over into their airspace. And so, yes, not only do I think that these kinds of surveillance platforms exist, I think that they've seen application in Iraq and Afghanistan and maybe even in Pakistan. And I think that, they are able to move. In fact, there is one story, just to recall, if you have a moment.
Sure.
There was a young couple that attended an opening I had at a gallery in Big Bear Lake in Southern California back around 1991, I think it was. And the lady actually worked at Northrop, the B-2 bomber production facility, Plant 42. And she said that one night that she came out from work about 11 o'clock at night, and she saw a number of vehicles stopped alongside the road, and some of them were other employees that she recognized from Northrop, and they were looking up in the sky and pointing and, you know, commenting about something in the sky, and she kind of glanced through the windshield, couldn't see anything. But she got out, and she said that what you could see was this immense black triangle, and she says you could make out the edges of it because the amount of smog that had blown up into the high desert from Southern California was illuminated by the glow of the city lights from Palmdale and Lancaster, which is the two metropolitan areas in the immediate vicinity of Plant 42. And she said, and so silhouetted against this sort of dull, glowing orange of the smog being illuminated by the city lights was this big black triangle. But she said that it almost appeared as though it was transparent. Because, she says, as it would pass over a certain part of the sky, you would see the stars there, and then as the vehicle passed in front of the stars, a star or something like a star would appear on the underside of the vehicle, and it would track across the vehicle, moving at the same speed as the vehicle's forward progress. But what it really was a kind of synthetic video system that was actually recording the light from the stars on the upper side of the vehicle and then projecting or creating an artificial scene of the star field moving across the belly of the vehicle.
Yeah, that was one of our earliest attempts at stealth.
Yes. And in fact, they had something like that. It was developed under, I think it was called the Yehudi program, where, and this is probably right at the end of the Second World War, where they were looking at ways of camouflaging and stealthifying aircraft, was by putting lots of little lights all over the aircraft, particularly on the undersides of the wings, so that in broad daylight, the upper surface of the aircraft could be painted a dull gray or even a medium gray, and with the amount of illumination it got from the sun, it would almost disappear in the distance. But the shadow side on the underside of the vehicle, the belly and the underside of the wings, would be much darker and contrasty with the background, so it would show up. So what they did is they put all these little lights on the underside of the aircraft, so it essentially canceled out the shadow sides of the vehicle so that it just completely vanished from view. And all it was just a bunch of little evenly spaced light bulbs.
Lights were used in World War II. I think, I'm not sure if the British started it or we did, where we had a special light put on a tank. And this light had a certain frequency to open and close the shutters of the light that was on the tank. It was a very extremely bright light. I don't know. It could have even been a million candle power. Mm-hmm. But by the shutters opening and closing at a certain rate of speed, it made the tank invisible if it was facing you. You couldn't...
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, you couldn't see the tank because of the way the shutters would flash the light on and off. It would look like nothing was there. It was an amazing experiment. At the end of the war, they had never used any of these tanks in battle, and they had 200 left. I think you could look it up probably on Wikipedia if you wanted.
Sure. Well, I will have to. That's amazing. I'll have to look that up. That's a very interesting piece of historical information.
So that's about it for today, Mark. I want to thank you. It's been a very interesting experience.
Oh, you're welcome, Ken.
Hope we didn't give you a sore throat.
No, I am feeling a little bit of scratchiness here, but, boy, I always enjoy talking with you, and I look forward to the next time.
Same here, Mark. You take it easy now.
All right. Thank you. You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.